Okay, August 12th, 1988. Bert Klein, interview by Todorovic, and we are on tape 2, side B. Okay, before lunch we were talking about the R&D project that you had at RAND, and we were talking about its reception both within RAND and also within the Air Force. Now, I know for briefings, there, in most cases, you would conduct a lot of briefings informally with the RAND staff there in order to get criticism and comment. And I was wondering if you remember any of the briefings that you held on the R&D study with the RAND staff in an informal way, if that was one of the forums in which you...
Yeah, it was, but I don't remember many comments.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Did you brief this study in pieces?
Yeah.
That is, the various case studies that made up a part of it in pieces, and then the overall conclusions, maybe in another tour. Where did you take it outside of RAND?
Oh, we went to headquarters, R&D, that was then in Baltimore, the Research and Development Command.
Mm-hmm.
Giving a briefing to General Powers, I guess it was, who was then head of R&D. He had previously had been head of SAC. And if there was any guy who was unreceptive to this kind of thinking, war. That was a terrible experience, I'll never forget it. He almost threw me out.
Oh, really? It was that, his reaction was that severe?
People in the Air Force didn't like this stuff at all. I mean, with the exception of those, a few guys like I was talking about, they were a distinct minority. Now, this is stuff that didn't go at all well in the Air Force.
Mm-hmm. When actually did the study end? That is, when were you more or less finished with the...
I would say about, as of the time I became head of the department, the economics department.
Mm-hmm.
I guess that was 62, was it? I don't know.
That would have been 62, I believe, which was when Hitch...
Well, Kershaw was head of the department for a while.
Head of the department, 62.
Yeah. Okay. Up till then.
Okay, so... then the study went on about 7 years, something like that. Well, what else were you doing while you were working on this study?
That's
or was that it? Was that pretty much
it.
A full-time?
That it. Well, there was a tremendous amount of studies written, materials, stacks and stacks of stuff written, case studies.
Mm-hmm.
And then a bunch of interim reports written, whatever you want to call them. And these were a lot of fun to do. We enjoyed doing them. And Oh, the other guy I was trying to think of worked on this was Tom Marshak, M-A-R-S-C-H-A-K. He teaches at Brooklyn. You see, it was, you know, it was, for economists, entirely new thinking about this whole logic of how you make decisions under uncertainty when you don't really know, so forth. You know, it was, for the guys involved, it was highly interested in the, and economists outside of Rand, you know, were very interested in these kinds of things.
Did you use outside consultants?
So yeah.
Did you pull in economists from outside?
No, for example, one outside consultant we had was, on this project was Can Aaron. From, you know who he is.
How is this spelled?
A-R-R-O-W. And he always was a big fan of of this project and the way, you know, I talked about R&D and so forth. You know, so it wasn't as if it wasn't as if you know, there was a very, very limited appreciation of this within Rand, but there was more an appreciation within the academic fraternity. You know, I wrote an article. There was a conference on inventive activity at the University of Minnesota in the 50s, and I wrote an article for that conference. Dick Nelson. He was a, it's another guy who was involved in these studies. He's now at New York University. But in any event, I wrote an article for this conference that was based on these studies. And that article got quoted all over. That was a famous article. And so, from that point of view, there was more favorable comment outside than inside, and more of a feeling that there was a feeling on all of our parts that we were learning something of long-run interest, that these were sort of basic issues, you know, that you as an economist wanted to understand that. I mean, just for the sake of understanding, but you can see what I mean.
Mm-hmm. Well, what about the economists within your own department at Rand? I mean, here's certainly people who are part of this fraternity. If economists outside Rand recognize the importance,
I don't say everyone. I say some.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
some.
I don't wanna,
yeah.
I would say that the economists in Rand were, for the most part, interested in system studies, and that those that were interested in system studies weren't interested in this kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
No, it was very little interaction.
Was there any economist in your own department at Rand who was particularly interested in the study you were doing, or who was most sympathetic?
Oh, well, sure. Thomas Marshak worked on it.
Mm-hmm.
Dick Nelson worked on it. Messini worked on it. They were all sympathetic. Nancy Nimitz didn't work on it, but she had a lot to do with it. Well, all these, she was very sympathetic. But the people who were driven, and this included Hitch, more by classical economic theory and systems analysis, which are closely related, I assume you know, they weren't turned on by this stuff. They were turned off by it. Ed Barlow was turned on by this. But where did Ed Barlow eventually go to work? Well, what's his name? The Darien Brothers.
Yeah.
Well, you see, that's a pretty progressive outfit.
Mm-hmm.
Or it was, anyway. Go ahead.
Yeah. In any case, even though people weren't necessarily receptive to the message that was coming out of your study, you were still supported. And
sure.
Nobody tried to stop the study at any point.
No.
It was allowed to go to completion.
Yeah. Hitch, I don't say Hitch was not in love with this study, but you know, he supported it, gave me raises, and of course Kolbaum was a big fan of the money, and we were good friends, and he was always asking me to come down to his office to tell me about how Douglas operated,
uh-huh.
And he loved to talk about it. And, didn't Frank mention me when you talked to him?
I'm sure he did. I have to go back and look at the transcript.
Yeah, I think he did. And so, sure, you know, so, no, I wasn't praised, but I wasn't, you know, no one was. I wasn't any kind of victim either. Mm-hmm. And you see, you know, the fact that a guy like John Williams liked what we were doing, and is very smart, that kind of impressed me.
Mm-hmm. Did you feel very collegially close to the rest of your department? The reason I ask is that, you know, you had been hired into a department, but for the first several years, you were working out of the Washington office, so you wouldn't have had very much contact with them.
Yeah. The answer is, you know, by very collegial, I assume you don't mean having lunch with someone from time to time. You mean something more than that.
I mean something more than that. I mean, I'm just trying to get a sense of
No, I didn't really. Mm-hmm. I didn't really. I got along with them. I get along pretty much with everybody. You know, I'm not a... But I didn't feel terribly collegial. I never felt very collegial with Wall Street. Mm-hmm. You know, he would invite me over to his house, vice versa. I like to talk to his wife, but I mean,
when was it that you became kind of, in a sense, Hitch's deputy in running the department at some point? But
well,
I'm not
I
sure
was
exactly.
Never Hitch's deputy in running. Joe Kershaw was. Joe Kershaw.
Mm-hmm.
And then he was department head for about a year or less.
Right. right as Hitch went to Washington. Right.
And then he decided to go to teach at Williams. And that's when Kolbaum made me here.
Okay. Okay, so you had never really managed the department or run the department in any way until Kolbaum made you head of the economics department.
Right. No. And it wasn't a, it is not one of my fondest memories.
Being head of the of the department.
Yeah.
It was a particularly rough period of time for the corporation in general.
That's right. Because that's when the Air Force was starting to screw down on Rand, right?
Mm-hmm.
Starting about 62.
There were congressional hearings and all sorts of pressure to more fully document how you were spending your time.
Yeah. No, it was not a happy period. And then of course this was the period of the war in Vietnam, which gave rise to a lot of division of opinions in Rand, of Ellsberg, for example. And there were all of these frictions. The Air Force was clamping down on us, and Frank Kolbaum now, who basically wanted to help the Air Force, was. Well, let me start back a few sentences. Okay. Well, I would say that the key issue that sort of is a tale of that waved the dog, wagged the dog, was the whole question about the man bomber. What you do about man bombers? When it came to missiles, Rand and the Air Force were speaking pretty much the same language. They both liked missiles. they wanted the missiles to be made less rather than more vulnerable, etc., etc., etc. There was no. But the man bomber was the key issue. The man bomber issue first came up when Eisenhower was president. It was a B-70 way back then. That was before 1960. And Herb York was then head of R&D in the military. Did you know that?
Oh, yeah.
And he was the first one to turn down the B-70. And he did it in good part on materials that he got from Rand.
Yeah, the B-70 recommendations, which were somehow or another tied together with the Strategic Offensive Forces study that was going on at the same time. That Ed Barlow was more or less coordinating.
Yeah.
Right? We're talking 57, 58, 59 period.
Yeah.
And the SOFS study, which seems to have been traumatic for Rand as an organization. because that was one in which a lot of uniformed Air Force people were brought to RAND and working.
Right, and I was working for Ed Barlow
on SOFs.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay.
So I was working for Ed on that. In fact, Gus Schubert was too. And so a lot of uniformed people were brought to RAND for that soft stuff. And RAND was taking a very much of an anti-70 B-70 point of view.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. You've gotten that from Ed Barlow, right?
Talked with Barlow a little bit about softs. And with Gus a little bit about it, and I've also done a fair amount of reading in the files, and a lot of the.
But it all points to what I just said was right, doesn't it? I haven't said anything.
Oh no, what you've said jibes with the things I've seen there, and the things I've seen in a bunch of memos written by Ed Lindblom. There was a bunch of memos on RAND organization about 1959 written by Ed Lindblom.
Yeah,
I know. E.C. Lindblom. And SOFs and the B-70 issue figure very prominently in those.
Right. So in any event, that, I would say, was the beginning of the end of the period of courtship between RAND and the Air Force. You see, as I told you over the phone, Hap Arnold wanted to have RAND have a lot of freedom, the critic, etc., etc. Kolbaum was in his life and so forth. But when the message came back from Ms. Sofson, which was a high level RAND, the message really was, we don't like that kind of thing, and if you RAND want to get along with the Air Force in the future, you gotta support the Air Force. You gotta help us sell our position. Well, you see, that was a dramatic experience for RAND. And, of course, Ed Barlow left. Well, they first went through that whole business where they abolished the divisions and they set up this, whatever you call it, the super council.
The research council?
Yeah. Remember, they abolished the divisions. Even before Hitch left, they had abolished the divisions and set up the research council. I don't know how that was connected with this, what I'm talking about, what connection, if any, there was. But did you ever find out why that was done?
No, I haven't. I'm not sure what the connection is. Let's see. 50, yeah. This is the 1960 reorganization when Ed Barlow was made director of projects.
Yeah.
And then there was a let's see, there's, I don't think the research council is shown here, but there is a research council.
Right. Well, in any event, I worked for Ed on that.
Mm-hmm.
And, but you see, and what I'm saying now is this, that that you could never, it would be, it was not possible for either RAND or nor the Air Force or anyone to make out a good case for the B-70 or a supersonic bomber capability. If you assume that it was directly competitive with missiles. Missiles always do the job better. So you needed a kind of a mission for for the bomber to do things that the missile couldn't do. Now this gets you into this whole warfighting capability jazz, where you're fighting a war and the missile, and the bombers are going out and attacking targets that can't be somehow attacked by missiles. They're doing some kind of a different job. Well, so there was a lot of pressure on RAND at that time to become involved in all of this warfighting stuff from the Air Force.
And this is basically creating a justification for the B-70.
Well, no one put it that quite that crassly. I mean, who weren't told that?
Well, my next question was how did the message, you know, how did the pressure get to RAND? What forms did it take?
Well, I only know that Frank called me down to his office. That was when I was head of the economics department. And asked me to get interested in warfighting. And I know that we used to have, department head meetings. And there was a whole lot of discussion about this at department head meetings. And for a while, I was kind of enthused about this warfighting thing for the simple reason that it's kind of fun. You know, these systems analyses that such as Wohlstetter engages in, you see, where you just, you're trying to discover which kind of basing is the best, and you do a classical system analysis. That's kind of dull, I you know, you sort of know the answer before you do anything. You don't need to do any work. You don't need a war game. You know the answer beforehand. I mean, you do a lot of fancy analysis to show what was obvious in the first place. I mean, that's the way I think, anyway. But the war game thing, you see, is kind of exciting because things are moving and happening, and you got to keep up with things as they happen. You got to do them in real time, you know. And for a while, you know, that's it. That was just kind of fun, and it's exciting, and I think it's, and then, and as long as you think only about that angle of it, the angle of how you play such war games. You can have fun from morning till night. The real twist, though, is if you know, sometime when you wake up, you know, in the morning and you're shaving, and you say to myself, how, by God, how could you hope to have such a nuclear war between the forces without spreading it into a war in which we'd all lose our lives? I mean, It's really fun until that disturbing thought reaches you. Mm. then it isn't so much fun anymore. By the time I left Rand, I was having that disturbing thought much more than before. Mm-hmm. People don't make decisions in the heat of war like they do over a game table, you know. In war's passions get aroused. There's a whole lot of feeling about, let's just let the bastards have it. So, you know, if you want, the morality of these studies begin to work.
Mm-hmm.
The moral issues.
Seems to be evident a general feeling of dis-ease among a lot of sensitive people at Rand at this particular time. It's I mentioned earlier that it's very evident in some of Brownlee Hayden's papers, and I'll go on pause for a moment. Okay, continuing. A certain feeling of uneasiness. Well, it's more than a feeling of uneasiness. There's the whole question that's going on around this same period of time at Rand. A lot of soul searching about what kind of an organization Rand is and what direction it should move in. Should it diversify its patronage beyond Air Force and take contracts from other people? Should it get bigger? If so, how big should it get?
Yeah.
All of these questions are coming out.
Right.
At
and
once.
What I want to suggest to you, and remember, don't believe everything I tell you. I mean, just, you know, I'm just giving it to you from my point of view. And I was saying, I think a whole lot of that broader soul searching that you're talking about, what sort of an organization, how much we should diversify, et cetera, et cetera. A lot of that broader soul searching had to do with the soul searching about the issue I just talked to you about.
Mm-hmm.
That's really the underneath issue. I mean, you know, I know a lot of people in Rand were soul searching about that issue, because I was there. I asked you what's it like now and so forth. I can't tell you what it's like now. I wasn't there now. But I can tell you that all the guys that I knew were engaged in the soul searching. And you see, and you know, this is getting me towards the point I was going to make. It seems to me that if you want to do good research for anyone, the Smithsonian Institute or such and such university or wherever you want to, you know, the most important thing maybe is to do research in an environment in which you feel you're being intellectually honest, you know. It's hard to say that, you know, either under the best, the very best of circumstances, with no constraints on you at all, it's hard to be intellectually honest, right? You know, it's much easier to preach that than to do it.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that if you want to get good research out of people, you have to be able, you know, those people have to be able to doing something that they feel is reasonably honest with themselves. most people feel that is threat or some, you know, mm-hmm. some importance to people. And I think that this whole war fighting thing got you into a business where people couldn't feel that way. You see, you can talk about the basing thing, the vulnerability, reducing the vulnerability, and to talk about it now, then, you can say we ought to have less vulnerability, and all sorts of studies. But if you say that, you're being kind of honest with the Air Force, you're being honest with yourself, so it needn't bother you. But when it gets into this whole business of how you fight a nuclear war. Now, you see, the thing that, during the time, the thing that brought this to my attention a lot, when I'm talking about this whole thing, as of about 1965, I was asked by McNamara to be a special assistant to his on a NATO study. So I was loaned by Rand to McNamara for a period of about 2 years. So I was a special assistant to him on a NATO study that took place in Europe. Well, what, what impressed me was that these military guys from the United States, mostly, wanted to fight a war with nuclear bullets, more or less as you fought World War II, and they were really mesmerized about that. You see, I'd worked for the Air Force all the time, but this point about a nuclear war comes much closer to home when you start talking about a ground war.
So you've got the Army and then you've got the NATO.
Right.
Forces, or representatives of the NATO forces as well, beyond
What impressed me was, one, that point number one, how stupid it was to think you could fight such a war. for example, when we had these sessions in this study, I was pointing out how, as a navigator, during World War II, one of our big jobs after dropping the paratroopers in Normandy was hauling gasoline for Patton's advancing army. Patton would have never been able to handle his logistics question without us. We won the war. I'm joking a little bit, but you see what I mean?
Oh, yeah.
But I said, how the hell would you haul that gasoline in the middle of a nuclear war? To bring up, a small disturbing element. And, the thing that that impressed me was that the U.S. was the only military establishment that believed in that jazz. The French didn't. They said that kind of thinking had cost them two world wars, and that was de Gaulle's reason for getting out of NATO. The British thought this idea of fighting a nuclear war was just for the birds, and they pooed it off. The British had a motto that I finally got McNamara to understand. This was it was General Mountbatten that invented this. They said that the best way to prevent a nuclear war is by getting a conventional brigade to the right place at the right time. I can tell by your smile that that must make some sense to you, doesn't it?
Yeah, I get the point, yeah.
What?
Yeah, I get the point.
And, now, one of the funniest things that happened at NATO, they had a study done in the Belgians did a study in their Joint Chiefs of Staff, or the equivalent of a big full-blown study in which they proved that if the U.S. really wanted to fight a nuclear war, they ought to go back to horses.
I see.
well, you can get the logic, right? I mean, that's, mm-hmm. You want to fight the war that Grant fought against Lee.
Yeah.
What?
Yeah.
This whole NATO experience just brought home very vividly to me how screwy all of this to my way of thinking, how screwy all this warfare business was. and so I just didn't have any stomach for it.
Well, that's pretty, it wasn't too many years after that then that you decided that you did leave.
No, I left about a year after that.
Oh, so this went on through 66 then?
Well, it went on through 65 or so.
Yeah.
And I left shortly after Harry Rowan became head of Rand.
Mm-hmm.
With a few months.
Yeah.
Because it just... No, I'm not saying, by the way, that I'm God and I'm right about all of these things. I'm just saying that...
Sure.
I'm just saying, you know, it seems to me that if you're not in sympathy with this kind of research that's being done, you should leave.
Yeah.
So I left. And, But I think that but I would guess that there's still that same malaise that there ever was over this issue, because, you know, I don't think I'm at all that unusual. I mean, I would think that
we're getting near the end of the tape. I think we have about 2 minutes left of tape to go. So what I'd like to do is to give you the rest of the time on the tape to give me whatever thoughts you'd like to give me on any subject whatsoever, or among the topics we've discussed today, anything you'd like to say in summation?
No,
for this first session.
Well, I think we pretty well covered it. Why don't we just leave it
okay.
Right here?
Well, thank you very much. I really appreciate your talking with me today. This is the end of tape 2, side 2.